tower site this afternoon. Our engineers are replacing a capacitor and need to reduce our transmitter power for a short while to complete the work safely. So we will be operating at reduced power probably no longer than an hour or two, beginning at 2:30 this afternoon. Thanks for your patience and understanding as we complete this important work. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. The scandal involving manipulation of international interest rates continues to rumble forward. Yesterday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner defended himself against accusations that he should have done more to address concerns over how the critical LIBOR rate is set. Now, LIBOR, you may recall, stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. It's the rate that banks use throughout the world as a benchmark for how much to charge consumers on mortgages and other loans. It's yet another somewhat obscure banking term that we're learning about in these hard economic times. To explain how an influential group of bankers in London comes up with this critical interest rate, NPR's Renee Montaigne spoke with Gillian Tett of the Financial Times.
The banks are supposed to report the best possible guess, if you like, of the price at which they would lend and borrow money in the markets for LIBOR. And I think for the most part, banks do try and do their best possible guess of what the price would be. But it's a bit like going into a neighborhood and saying, okay, so what are these houses worth in this neighborhood? You could either go and look at what kind of deals have actually been struck by realtors and say, what was the price that people paid for their homes? Or you could go to the realtors and say, well, what do you think a house is worth? And as everyone knows, you know, if you're making up a price on the basis of what you think it's worth, it might be true, it might not be true. But it does seem that at times of crisis, like in 2008, the banks were not always reporting accurate numbers. And even before that, it appears that some traders at some banks were quite deliberately rigging the numbers to try and get better financial deals for themselves.
So what would have been the difference if these bankers had reported a more accurate LIBOR number? I mean, how have, say, Americans been hurt?
Well, specifically during 2008, the fact that banks were underreporting the level at which they were borrowing probably actually benefited Americans, because it meant that anybody who was trying to raise a home mortgage or a corporate loan was probably getting it cheaper than, or slightly cheaper than, they would have done otherwise. But the crucial thing to understand is that before 2008, there were cases when banks were deliberately overreporting the number, because particular traders were trying to get a particular number for a deal that would be beneficial for themselves. And in those circumstances, it's possible that homeowners and companies actually lost out. And as a result, the potential for litigation now is very big.
Well, in fact, the city of Baltimore and a pension fund in Connecticut have sued. One small bank in Wisconsin has filed a suit against J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America and Citigroup, accusing them of colluding to set the rate artificially low. Where do you see this scandal headed?
So there are really two things going on right now, or three things. One is a general erosion amongst the public in confidence in the financial sector. Secondly, you have specific scandals erupting at some banks like Barclays, which could end up creating, you know, at best management upheaval, at worst very costly, damaging litigation. And then more broadly, there's a fact that you could see a wave of lawsuits from disgruntled investors or investment groups going forward who are particularly unhappy about deals that have been linked to LIBOR in the past. At the moment, regulators on both sides of the Atlantic are talking about whether it's possible to overhaul the LIBOR process and create a more credible, more trustworthy index. But unfortunately, replacing LIBOR is going to be quite hard, precisely because it is so fundamental for the system.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Gillian Tett is the U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. She spoke to us from New York.
Pediatric leukemia is a cancer of the blood and bone marrow. With treatment, about three-quarters of affected children are able to beat the disease. But for those with what's known as high-risk leukemia, the odds of survival are much worse. Washington University pediatric oncologist Dr. Todd Drewley has been trying to use genetics to understand why some leukemia is so hard to treat. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra.
When I was training to be a pediatric cancer specialist, we had to tell families that their children had cancer or leukemia. And it struck me right away that almost every family would ask you the same two questions. And the first question was always, is my child going to live or die? And while there's no guarantees, we have 30 or 40 years of good research that we can use to give an approximate answer and hopefully provide some insight to that question. But the second question was much more frustrating, and it was, why did this happen to my child? My child's always been healthy. The mother and the father are almost always healthy. These cancers don't seem to run in families most of the time. And so it comes as a bolt of lightning out of the blue. And here in the 21st century, you'd think we'd be able to say directly, this is why your child got cancer, but that's just not the case.
And so tell me about your research. How have you gone about trying to find an answer?
Well, we've had a revolution in the last 5 years in the United States with DNA sequencing. We often think of cancer being caused by something that is acquired, whether someone's smoking or they're suntanning or they live next to a toxic waste, who knows what it is, but there's something causing a change in them. But what we know is that these children almost never have those types of circumstances. So why do we see so many 4- and 5-year-olds getting cancer? So it makes us think that there could be things that they're born with, not things that they acquire, that are predisposing them to getting cancers or affecting their ability to be treated appropriately.
What have you done so far to try to address this?
Because there's only a few thousand of these cases every year in the United States, we're part of the Children's Oncology Group, which is a national consortium of pediatric cancer centers. And I've asked them to provide me with hundreds of DNA samples from children that had high-risk leukemias. And we found two genes that were very important for metabolizing the drugs that we give children with leukemia, steroids and another class of drugs called anthracyclines. They had more mutations in those genes than the healthy children. And these were genetic changes that they were born with. These weren't genetic changes acquired in the leukemia. And the important point here is that the children that had these genetic changes tended to die more quickly because they had exceptionally aggressive leukemia.
And so how can we use this information to actually help children who have leukemia?
Well, we're at the cusp of using DNA sequencing as a typical lab test. So just like an X-ray, just like a blood test, we're right at the beginning where we can simply order DNA sequencing of any number of genes. So with the information that we have today, we could suggest that these children don't need to go through months and months of intensive chemotherapy. It might be most appropriate to send them straight to bone marrow transplantation. And bone marrow transplantation, we know, is most successful when children are at their strongest and healthiest because it is an intensive procedure. So if you can spare them months of really intense treatment and take them directly to bone marrow transplant, we would expect that their outcomes would be much better than they have been historically. Now, in the meantime, what we'd like to do is try to understand how these genetic changes alter proper drug metabolism and then design a treatment, a very a la carte type of a strategy, and say, based on your genetics, these are the 5 or 6 medications that are going to be most efficacious for you. And I don't think we're that far away from being able to do that. Now, whether that translates into higher cure rates remains to be seen, but I'm hopeful.
That was Washington University pediatric oncologist Todd Druley. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Global Commodity Analytics, Lafayette; Woodyard Allen Farms, Ridge Farm; Atlas Travel, Decatur; and Thorpe Farms, Gibson City. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy share more than just being husband and wife. They are passionate about the subject of rabies.
She would tell me stories about rabies and how amazing and diabolical of a virus this was, the way it kind of possesses its hosts.
We love rabies.
The couple talks with us about their new book, Rabid, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 19th of July, 2012. It was on this date, 1954, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Fellowship of the Ring was first published, the first volume of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It was the sequel to his book The Hobbit, which came out in 1937. Hobbits, small human-like creatures, hairy feet, large appetites, but simple appetites, who generally like to stay close to home. Tolkien once wrote, "I am, in fact, a hobbit in all but size. I like gardens, trees, and unmechanized farmlands. I smoke a pipe and like good, plain food." The Hobbit was the story of Bilbo Baggins, who went on an adventure through Middle-earth and came home with a magic ring. It was successful in 1937. The publisher asked for a sequel, and so Tolkien spent the next 17 years working on The Lord of the Rings, made elaborate charts to keep track of the events of the story. Finally, in the fall of 1949, he typed the final copy himself, a 500,000 words, which he typed on a typewriter on his lap with two fingers. And the first volume came out on this day in 1954. It's the anniversary of the first convention for women's rights, the Seneca Falls Convention, which began on this date in 1848, organized by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, which called for religious, economical, and political equality, which was greeted by the press with a great deal of scorn 72 years before women would be granted the right to vote. It's the birthday of Charles Horace Mayo, Rochester, Minnesota, 1865, co-founder of the Mayo Clinic with his older brother William. In 1919, the two of them formed the Mayo Properties Association, a not-for-profit organization, and transferred all their private holdings into the association. And the two of them began drawing salaries instead of a share of the profits. The Mayo Clinic, the country's first integrated group medical practice. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen, Tornado Warning. That is not the country for poetry. It has no mountains. Its flowers are plain and never poisonous. Its gardens are packed into blue mason jars. There are no hedges bordering the roads. The sky flies up from the ditches, loose in every direction. Yet I knew it to be passionate, even in its low rolling hills, where a red tractor pushed through the oat field, cutting down gold straw and beating a stream of grain into the wagon trailing behind in the stubble. I knew